Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappy on social media. On behalf of the Versus History editorial team, today we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Dr. Casper Melville from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And today, Dr. Casper Melville is here to talk to us all about, wait for it, jungle drum and bass music, which is one of the focuses in his new book, It's a London Thing, How Rare Groove, Acid House and Jungle Remap the City. How are you today, Casper? And thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Patrick.
Tell us a little bit about you then, your background, and how you became so passionate about music generally and the impact it has.
Thank you. So I was born in London. I'm in my mid-50s now. So I was born in the late 60s, but I'm not a child of the 60s. I became a teenager at the end of the 1970s. And I suppose I'm really a child of the 80s in terms of my kind of development of my music and cultural tastes. I grew up in a mixed part of South London, in Stockwell, which is just down the road from Brixton. So which has a large Afro-Caribbean population, predominantly Jamaican population. So I was very aware, from early on in my life that London was a racially mixed place, but it was a racially mixed place, which there was a lot of tension and there was a lot of problems around that as well. In the school that I went to, Pimlico School, which is in, obviously in Pimlico, just on the north side of the river from me, it was very mixed in terms of, there's about 2,000 kids, a mixture of white middle class kids like me, working class kids from the older working class communities in Pimlico. There were two big estates in Pimlico, Lillington Gardens and Churchill Gardens, sort of oriented towards Chelsea Football Club. But there was also a lot of black kids there from who came over from Vauxhall and Brixton as well. So it was very mixed. There were Asian kids as well, because various waves of Asian migration had already started, particularly migration from East Africa and West Africa after Idi Amin came to power in Uganda. So it was evident that London was a multicultural place, but it was a tense place. There was, in 81, there was a big riot in Brixton and other parts of the UK. And again, in 1985, I was aware at the time, I think, that this was a response on the part of the black community to over-policing of those areas. There were racist skinheads in my school. There was NF graffiti. There was, Margaret Thatcher was in power with this kind of authoritarian populism and sort of, flag waving sense of, Imperial Britain, which didn't seem to include black people. So I was very aware of all of that going on. And that really inflected my sort of cultural understanding and my music consumption. Some of the first music I was exposed to at school was reggae, because reggae was so strong in the black communities in London. Sound system culture was emerging. And even the pop music was being influenced by that. You could feel the reggae influence in pop music. And what you got, the earliest kind of musical form that really captured me was two-tone, which was this combination of punk attitude and reggae ska music in particular, from a Jamaican form of music from the late 60s, bands like The Specials and Madness and The Selector. So I think my orientation towards, it felt like you had to pick sides at school, and I was not going to pick the side of the racist. So I aligned myself with my black friends. There was actually a race riot in my school. We became the first school in London to ever need to have security guards in, because older boys were coming into the school and causing trouble. And so I feel my choice of music was strongly inflected by my politics and by a kind of emerging sense of the importance of anti-racism and the importance of standing up to that. This was also the era of Rock Against Racism and the Anti-Nazi League, who organized big festivals and brought music to the fore, where they put punk and reggae together on the stage. So I went to see so the Slits and the Pop Group, but alongside Misty and Roots and Aswad and Steel Pulse. We were also lucky enough to have a Ken Livingstone as the mayor at the time, well, not the mayor, the leader of the GLC, the Greater London Council, which subsequently was dissolved by Margaret Thatcher. But during the high point of the GLC, there was a lot of music being brought into London to sort of go hand in hand with the celebration of multicultural London. So I got to see Stevie Wonder, I got to see Gil Scott-Heron. So music and politics and issues around race were always wrapped up in my young life. And that's what drew me into, you know, the great riches of the Afro-diasporic sort of musical landscape, you know, stemming from, you know, African-American culture, but also from Caribbean culture, particularly Jamaican culture, and also influences from West Africa as well. So that has been in my mind and something I've cared about ever since I can remember. And when I became a teenager and was able to start going out, of course, that was the 1980s, was the kind of development of a very powerful club culture in London as well, which drew me in. And I was fascinated by it, and I wanted to go and dance, and I wanted to be part of it. I wasn't a musician, and I wasn't a DJ, although I was fascinated by DJs. So I started writing about it, you know, almost for sort of fanzines. I wrote for magazines like Blues and Soul, a Touch magazine, which was a magazine which came out of Kiss FM, which was a pirate station in the mid 80s, but became a legitimate station later on. So that kind of those set of questions about the relationship between popular culture, music in particular, and issues, sort of social issues and race and identity and politics was always inbuilt in, and I think I'm still on that same path to this day.
So, what is your book, It's a London Thing, How Rare Groove, Acid House and Jungle Remap the City, all about? And why did you choose to write it?
Well, what's it all about? Good point. In some ways, it was my attempt to kind of capture the threads of kinds of relationships I've just described to you, thinking back to let me say this. It started with jungle in a weird way. Now, jungle is a musical genre of the mid-1990s. We'll talk about it in more detail in a minute. But when jungle emerged in London, I wasn't in London, I was in San Francisco. I lived in America for most of the 90s, so I wasn't a participant. It was something I was picking up on tapes of people's radio shows that were being sent to me, or import records. So when I first heard Goldie's Timeless album, or the first singles from Ronnie Size, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. First of all, the music is incredibly forward thinking and you know, sort of, it's really hard to understand what it is. You've got these deep, massive bass lines, you've got these break beats, you've got these voices, these strange samples. So I got captured by jungle, and actually I came back to London in 1997, and I went to Goldsmiths to do an MA, and my explicit aim was to try and think about how did jungle come about? What is going on with jungle? What's happened? And that quest to understand jungle drove me backwards in time to reflect on the period during which I'd grown up that I just talked about, you know, back into the 70s and even into the 60s, to try and understand how this music, which was this obvious hybrid between different kinds of mainly Afro-diasporic music, but also with the influence, a kind of British spin on it, which had almost a punky influence, very much a do-it-yourself kind of attitude, but also very clearly influenced by acid house, what had happened at the end of the 1980s, the rave culture which had emerged from that. So I wanted to kind of unpick those threads and trace it back. And the more I looked at it, having written, you know, initially just about jungle for my MA thesis, I went on to do a PhD, and that led me back to think about, okay, so what was happening before jungle, the hardcore era, so-called, of the early 1990s, then back into acid house of the late 1980s, then even back to rare groove, which was the subculture, the kind of club culture of the mid to late 1980s in London, how that informed jungle, and then back all the way, and it led me back to the root of this in the UK, which was sound system culture from Jamaica. And one of the ways that you're led back into this, it's actually not that hard to be led back, because the moment you start talking to prominent junglists, jungle DJs, people like Fabio or Groove Rider, they didn't start with jungle. They innovated jungle, but they had been before jungle, they were rave and acid DJs. And before that, they were soul, funk, hip hop, rare groove DJs. And then before that, they had grown up within a sound system culture. So in the life stories and biographies of the people who are making jungle, there were other people as well, younger people, white people who had not lived like that. But the innovators of jungle, if you follow their life story, you followed a history which went all the way back to, you know, the late 1950s, at least, when sound system culture from Jamaica first touched down in the city in Britain. And it helped And I realized that in order to tell that story, you had to actually tell the story of, you know, the musical story of the Windrush generation, which also at the same time I was writing this, obviously became hugely controversial around, you know, the scandal of the Windrush. I don't know if your listeners would be familiar with this, but this is a lot of people who had come from Jamaica legitimately with British passports, or perhaps as children, not with passports, who suddenly were denied the right to be in Britain because there was no record of their right to be here, often because that those records had been chucked away by the immigration services. So that was the real sort of aim, to try and capture that story. It is in part my own story. And I do, you know, there are parts in the book where I write short passages which are kind of reflecting on my own experiences in club culture from the 1980s all the way to the end of the 1990s.
Thank you, Casper. I think it's worth saying at this point that from this point onwards in the podcast, we're going to focus exclusively on jungle drum and bass. So, setting you up here, how would you describe jungle / drum and bass music to someone who had never heard it before?
Well, I'll have to do it a little bit by comparison to other music. So I would imagine most people will have heard house music. And if they haven't, let me just say that house music is defined rhythmically by a dominant 4-4 beat, which goes like this. That's you know, most house music sounds like that at rhythmic level. Jungle, which in many ways is similar to house music, some people have even argued it's an offshoot of house music, and house music was spread around the world via the rave explosion. It was music from Chicago and Detroit and New York, but it actually really blew up when it came to the UK via Ibiza at the end of the 1980s. Jungle takes that pattern and takes the kind of production aesthetics of house, i.e. it's digitally produced, but it changes the rhythmic pattern. So instead of that even 4-4 beat, what you get is a combination of a deep and quite slow reggae-influenced bass line, like that, with so-called breakbeats. Breakbeats are these very intense drum patterns, which are characteristic of hip-hop, which itself have been taken from usually 1970s funk records, the little sections of breakbeat, kind of fast drum patterns. And jungle puts these two things together, which had hitherto never been put together. So what you get is a music which has almost two rhythmic pulses. One is a slower, perhaps 80 BPMs bass pulse, usually reggae derived. And then the other is these breakbeats. But unlike in hip hop, which runs about 80 to 100 beats per minute, the breakbeats in jungle are sped up. They are faster than any human drummer, or apart from the most skilled human drummers, could possibly, you know, do naturally. So they're produced technically and sped up to incredible speeds, sometimes 160 beats per minute. So for some people, some people think jungle isn't even music, or it sounds like noise, or it sounds very chaotic or intense. But actually, when you listen to it, you have this amazing balance within the mix of this deep, slower bass line with these very fast drums. And jungle tends to change a lot. So the typical jungle tune will not stay at the same pace throughout. There'll be slow passages, then very intense fast passages. And then folded into that will be all manner of things. In the early days of jungle, it might be kind of samples from kids' TV programs or from horror films or kung fu films, just little vocal samples. Sometimes someone chatting on the mic, but usually not a hip hop rapper, not telling a story, but just little snatches. And then sometimes also jazz instrumentation might come in there, or in the mid 1990s, the most popular form, and really what jungle really is the moment when the kind of the voice of the Jamaican MC, known as the DJ, confusingly in Jamaican culture, talking over the mic, chatting rhythmically over the mic, using a style which is strongly influenced by Jamaican music, U-Roy and some of these great toasters from the 1970s, but also dancehall, but also using Cockney slang, using local references, using sometimes American accents. So switching, what they call in sociology, code switching, you know, often these are massively predominantly Black British people, Black British men with a sound system background, but innovating a new way of talking on the mic, which combines all of these different elements and which clearly led on to the development of new forms of music in the UK, like grime, which is a kind of British variant of hip hop. but with still with a very strong jungle influence. So I hope that that's captured something of what's unique about jungle.
Clearly, no musical genre is born out of a vacuum. Nothing is monocausal, and that includes the origin of music. So what influences, events, and individuals paved the way for bringing jungle music into existence in the early 1990s?
Yeah, I locate it in, as I have a tendency to do, as I referred to earlier on, in, you know, let's think about it in terms of racial politics. The black community in Britain suffered extreme forms of racism, you know, institutionalized racism, lack of access to jobs, proper housing, poor educational provision. And in the light of that, Afro-Caribbeans who had come to the UK, many of whom were British citizens who, you know, had been educated in the British system and educated to think Britain was superior and also the mother country. When they came here, they realized that that was a false promise, that they were denied full access, that they were having to battle with racists on the streets. That led to the Black British community in some way turning inward and developing its own cultural institutions, having been somewhat sidelined or barred in many ways from the cultural institutions of British working class life, like football terraces or the pub, which were dangerous places to be if you were Black in the 70s and 80s. So they developed this their own alternative, what Paul Gilroy calls semi-autonomous social spheres, built around these huge sound systems, which were playing Jamaican music throughout the 70s and 80s. Potent, amazing music from Jamaica being blasted into the British city. These were predominantly Black events, although they weren't racially exclusive. And of course, you couldn't limit the spread of the music because you can't limit how music, you know, it sort of circulates. So everyone in London was hearing that music who was inclined to, or at least a lot of people, and especially those people who were sharing multicultural space. Then you got the rave moment. You know, you got acid house, which arrives at the end of the 1990s. It's a different kind of music. It's not reggae derived. It is Black music of a kind, but it's a much more technological music. It moves away from jazz and especially from soul music and from the kind of romantic idea. And it's got this kind of intensity to it. Obviously, it went hand in hand in the UK also with the drug ecstasy, which kind of created a very intense environment. And during that period, at the end of the 1990s, end of the 80s, early 90s, a lot of white British people, especially white men who hitherto would not have been seen dead on a dance floor, they'd be standing at the bar, you know, while the girls were on the dance floor. Dancing was considered to be feminine and, you know, possibly gay and something that was not something that a man did. Rave got that population, in fact, the whole, you know, large chunks of the British population onto the dance floor and became a huge phenomenon. Okay, so that's, you know, a great and exciting thing. And the early days of rave were mixed, multicultural, especially in London. You know, it was a new phase of club culture for everyone, young Black and white people. But gradually, rave, as it spread around the UK, you know, became whiter in many ways. This is obvious because once you get outside of the city and there aren't that many, you know, it's a kind of monoracial, it's white. There are fewer Black people around. But also there are, you know, talking to the people that I interviewed, there was a sense in which raves were not that welcoming to a Black audience. People, you know, Black youth who had been excluded on the door of clubs and bars in London throughout the 80s and 90s were finding themselves excluded from rave culture. And the music itself was changing. And you got a greater influence from Northern Europe, particularly from Belgium, the RNS label, from Holland, Gabba. These kind of forms of rave music, which were getting further and further away from the basic model of Afro-diasporic music with which Black London, Black British people are familiar, and arguably, I think, musically less interesting. This is my experience. And there were many other options for Black clubbers because this was the high point of hip hop and swing beat and dance hall, and there were lots of other things going on. So raves became whiter, even as many of the key rave DJs were Black DJs, people like Fabio and Groove Rider and Carl Cox and Colin Dale and Booker T, who had come up on the funk and reggae and soul scene, had been attracted to rave, acid house. Sorry, I should clarify, acid house is the musical genre at the end of the 80s, which then turns into what's called rave culture. Raves are the big outdoor parties, which are the social sort of scene for acid house. Anyway, these Black DJs became very popular DJs, playing to these huge crowds, you know, sometimes 15,000, 25,000 people in these big out of the city spaces. But I think that there was a sense in which that they wanted to innovate it and they wanted to change it. And they were rather disturbed by the sense that there was this division. You know, their black audiences weren't that necessarily that attracted to the rave scene. And so they started making changes. And one of the things that one of the key moments I focus on is the two DJs, Fabio and Groove Rider from Brixton, who were playing at a club at Heaven in central London, a gay club, actually, but was a key site of rave culture. And they started to mess around with the house music that was the standard form of those clubs. And instead of having, as I referred to you before, that very even 4-4 pulse, which is the characteristic pulse of rave music, which is very easy to dance to and, you know, allows a lot of people to get on the dance floor. They started messing around with it, playing dub versions, scratching and cutting it, really messing up the kind of smooth surfaces of house music in a way that was quite controversial. A lot of ravers didn't like it. They felt it was disruptive, that it was, you know, it was spoiling their high in some way. But driving that innovation forward through their command of digital technology, which they were starting to develop, you know, an understanding of, using often secondhand gear and, you know, not reading the manual, but just messing around with samplers and digital audio software. This is where jungle started to emerge. These new sounds started to emerge. And black producers in particular, like Terry T and Paul Ibiza, who started a record label, started, reggae elements started creeping back into the music. Reggae elements, which had been very suppressed or were latent at the end of the 80s, but was part of the musical experience of these people. Because as I said, they grew up within sound system culture. Their dads, brothers, uncles ran sound systems. This reggae element started to appear, 92, 93. And there was this strong sense that something new was happening. And you could see it in the clubs, because suddenly a black audience was returning to these rave clubs. And there was a kind of cleavage between those people who were kind of rave purists or techno heads who wanted to keep it clean. And in some ways, there was a racialized narrative about, you know, not allowing this dangerous, scary, bad influence that jungle supposedly connoted. But in fact, you got a moment where there was a real coming together of the rave culture with the reggae culture in so-called jump up ragga style reggae, where you got the MCs from the sound systems, like General Levy, who had been a reggae sound system DJ. You know, his song Incredible with M-Beat, which was quite a big hit in 1984, announced this new sort of, it was almost like a reclaiming by the black DJs of the space of the dance floor, which had been ceded to, you know, others during the earlier part of the 90s. So in many ways, I think, you know, jungle might be considered to be kind of the return of reggae, or even reggae's revenge on club culture after a period of time when other kind of electronic influences from Northern Europe had been more prominent.
What wider impact on culture, society, fashion, and perhaps other musical genres has jungle music had, and why?
Well, jungle has been hugely influential. I mean, there's a whole politics which I talk about how what we call this thing, as you've mentioned, sometimes people use the term jungle drum and bass. Jungle, which burst out in 1994 with this General Levy track and others and some very big clubs, became quite controversial. It was thought to be a kind of public order problem by the police, because they often had very overpacked raves. They didn't have very good crowd control. There was a degree of menace about it. You know, it was a street culture, you know, often coming from some of the tougher parts of London, especially, you know, Tottenham and some of the estates in the northeast of London. So it was, you know, it was quite hardcore. And there was an attempt to kind of gentrify it in a way, or at least change it. The jungle split into lots of different subgenres. Drum and bass was the name that kind of replaced jungle. And then there was intelligent, and there was jump up, and there was, you know, all kinds of, there was generic splitting. And partly this was an inevitable consequence of the fact that loads of new creative people came into the scene, younger people, and started innovating. So for example, UK garage, so-called, or speed garage, it was called at the time, or sometimes two-step, was an adjacent genre, often made by people who had been making jungle a couple of years earlier, they sort of returned to the 4-4 beat, gave it a skippier edge, used some of the jungle tricks, and innovated this new culture of garage, which was very influential at the end of the 1990s. And that leads almost directly into the development of grime, actually. Although grime feels somewhat different because it's very vocalist led, it feels more like hip hop, it's often slower. In fact, you know, the jungle is usually cited by the grime artists as being a key influence on the development of grime and into drill now and others. Then there was the genre of dubstep, which was another kind of twist on how to combine sort of reggae influences and electronic music, which again was quite popular at the end of the 1990s and spread around the world. It was picked up in America and became part of the kind of the return of dance music to America, which had been, as I said, innovated in Chicago and Detroit by Black, often gay producers and audiences, and largely ignored by white America. Once it came through Europe and was kind of laundered through Europe and through the rave scene, it returned to America as so-called EDM, electronic dance music. And dubstep was one of the strongest parts of that. And for many people, many younger people may feel that the king of dubstep is, you know, Skrillex from America or Dead Mouse or one of these kind of characters, because it became such a huge thing in the States at the beginning of the 21st century. So in terms of all of those influences, jungle is absolutely fundamental, actually. And some people go so far as to argue that it's the last sort of original genre of music with a sense of the future. So the theorist Mark Fisher famously talks about jungle's future shock. If you'd have played a jungle tune to someone from a few years earlier, it would have blown their minds. And he felt that actually it was the last truly kind of local, organic almost, you might say, music scene before the influence of the internet and globalization took a hold and has kind of messed up or remixed genre in terms of our understanding. Style-wise, I think jungle was kind of really interesting mix of a kind of what you found on the dance floors was a mix of kind of people dressed in kind of urban combat gear, as if, you know, the city was a war zone, with kind of funky dreads and combat boots and jackets, and then this kind of super flash clothing, this kind of machino and other kinds of designer wear. So it was a moment of kind of, there was a moment of excess, and actually that excess went fed into UK garage, which was very much about popping champagne corks and fancy cars and a kind of ghetto fabulous blinging. So it was influential there. I mean, that clothing influence has sort of, I think, you know, been diluted by the kind of the way in which fashion has now become kind of harder to pinpoint. People don't tend to dress to match their particular subcultural affiliation like they used to. It's much more of a mix-up. So in all those ways, hugely influential. Also in the establishment of a strong economy, an economy which is actually not built by, you know, capitalism primarily, or at least it's kind of DIY capitalism, often controlled by or run by Black Londoners or Black British people who have not found it easy to kind of lay their hands on the means of production in the larger media scape for institutional racist reasons. They built a network of pirate radio stations, of clubs, of record labels, you know, like V Recordings that Brian G and Jumping Jack Frost have been running for more than 25 years now. And then what jungle was able to do, exploiting partially the impact of the, you know, digital technologies and the internet and social media as that grew, is internationalize. So jungle went massively international, as you said. Eventually, jungle laps up on the shores of the States. You know, there's a scene in San Francisco. Jungle's massive in Los Angeles, influenced music production across America. There are jungle scenes in Sardinia. You know, there are festivals all around the world, even in you know, Middle East, in Dubai, Singapore, Australia. Jungle went outernational, to use a reggae term. And now exists and is actually still quite, you know, I say still, during the past year, clearly all music cultures have suffered severely from lockdown. But jungle is still alive and is still doing its work, but it's not just doing it. It's not stayed within the city or the place where it was gestated. It's become a potent culture and economy, and has provided revenue and income and actually a sense of the positivity and the potential of a multicultural environment like London. You know, it was praised by, you know, Chris Smith in his book Creative Britain at the end of the 1990s. You know, he even mentions Ronnie Size as being emblematic of a new form of sort of multicultural entrepreneurialism, which allowed Britain to kind of, you know, stake its claim to being, you know, cool Britannia and have come back and all of that sort of thing. So it remains a potent force, but I'm not, you know, it's one of many musical forms, which is still circulating around. So you still get a sense of that it's in motion. There's a younger generation in the UK doing different kinds of jungle. It's influenced the jazz scene in the UK, and it's influenced musical production in electronic music throughout the world.
In many ways, Casper, jungle drum and bass music has survived, thrived, and gone global, when other similar genres, such as UK garage, have not. I remember myself, when I first started going out in, say, 2000, 2001, in London, UK garage was everywhere. There were multiple nights on in multiple night spots, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and sometimes even Sunday. Jungle drum and bass was still there, but it was on the back burner in London. But jungle drum and bass has survived and thrived when perhaps garage hasn't to the same extent. So what do you think accounts for the relative success of jungle as a genre?
That's a good question. I think, okay, there's a number of different things. Let's take dubstep as an example. I think dubstep is a good example of a genre which didn't actually have a kind of strong social base. It was very much a genre produced amongst a kind of elite of music producers who were experimenting with new forms, but it didn't represent a kind of connection to definable communities. And therefore, it kind of ran its course rather rapidly in the UK. And I think went around the world and became a kind of another flavor, but it didn't ever have a kind of social embeddedness as jungle and drum and bass had. That's one thing to say. Another thing to say is, don't discount garage, because garage will come back again in other forms and remains. I think the thing about garage is we should see it as the precursor to grime. So a lot of the kind of energy and production aesthetic which underpinned garage fed directly into grime and is still there. And many of the producers within who are making grime at the moment also make garage or have also made garage. And I think that... like I said, I suspect there'll be return of garage in a variety of different ways. It won't go away, but it's one of many alternatives. The thing about the jungle drum and bass thing, I think it's got quite a clearly defined set of kind of aesthetic parameters, which are recognizable and very exciting. You know, there is a way in which jungle is a sort of funky punk, and therefore really appeals to teenagers the world over. So it's got this, it replicates itself by attracting new followers because of this intensity and because of this kind of this sense of possibility which is embedded in its form, even as it mutates. And obviously it's mutated in lots of different ways and gone in lots of different directions. I think it kind of embodies a certain sort of combined sense of both of sort of dread and fear. You know, after all, it emerges in a period which was defined for many people by so-called pre-millennial tension, to use Tricky's album title, a sense of, you know, inner city pressure, a sense of this is actually a response to the huge pressure of racism, of social inequality, of gentrification. And this is our kind of cry for help, but a kind of strong statement of that we are going to stand against that, of resistance. There's an element of resistance, even in the kind of aesthetic form of jungle, which I think still matches the kind of situations that we're in today in terms of, you know, rampant neoliberal policies, massive increase in social inequality. I mean, this is true of London, but it's also true of many other places in the world, and offers a sense that you can kind of rage against that. And you can resist it, but in your resistance, it's not a kind of futile act of violence. It's actually a creative act which creates beauty as well as a sense of dread and fear and kind of possibility. And in that way, it is similar to punk, but you can dance to it. So it's also got a social utility, just like all Afro-diasporic music. You know, it's not art for art's sake. It's actually part of an integrated system where the dance floor, getting people together in real face-to-face time to build a kind of a culture, and a kind of an economy, jungle still carries that potential with it. And it has not exhausted, partly because it the things that went together to combine jungle are so flexible, and there's so many things that you can say with all of those different textures of bass and drums and voice. So it's carrying that sort of electronic part of the diaspora, of the diasporic musical world forward, and not just in parts where you would imagine that that diaspora would live, but like I said, in Australia, like you said, in Russia, and in many other places in the world. So it's got this really fascinating afterlife. And now there's a new generation. And it's great to see that, among that generation, a lot more women than there were in the first articulation of Jungle. Of course, there was Chemistry and Storm, who DJed with Goldie at Metalheads, but there was, and DJ Rap, but there was only a handful of DJs. But now, in many ways, Jungle is being driven and led by people like DJ Sherelle and DJ Noir in Los Angeles. And they're folding in new forms into the music. New Forms is the name of Ronnie Size's album that he won the Mercury Prize for. And I think it's a good way of describing Jungle, because it's a kind of very open palette. You can in principle sort of fold any other kind of music into the Jungle model, and it works, whether it's jazz or soul, R&B, folk, influences from world music. All of these have popped up in the Jungle aesthetic universe.
How and why did MCs and MCing become so integral to the Jungle scene? I'm talking about MCs that, you know, were there from the inception or genesis of Jungle, perhaps like, you know, Flux, Skibidi, Shabba, Det, GQ, Fearless, the Ragga Twins. I mean, the list goes on. How and why are they so prominent and significant and pivotal in the Jungle scene, when perhaps they are less important in other forms of electronic music, such as, say, house?
Yeah, I think, you know, the MC, you know, again, just to clarify, in Jamaican sound system culture, the person who's talking on the mic is called the DJ. And that derives from disc jockey, from the element of the disc jockeying, which was talking on the radio. But let's call them MC for the purposes of clarity. MC, master of ceremonies, which is what you call the vocalist, or the person who's talking over the music in hip hop. What happened in Jungle is that, initially, as I said, the shift from a reggae and then soul and funk based music scenes of the 80s into rave cut off that immediate connection to sound system culture. And so for quite a long time, you didn't hear a voice in acid house music or in house music in general. It was much more about the digital rhythm and the kind of disorientating synth washes and things like that, the intensity of the music rather than the voice, which was, you know, an interesting moment. But what Jungle allowed, primarily because of the way it has this rhythmic dualism, the deep bass running slowly and the fast break beats and lots of space in the music, it opened up space for these guys like Skibidi, Shabba, MC Det, who had worked in sound system, reggae sound system culture, but now found that they could work with the reggae bass lines in Jungle. I mean, when I interviewed Cleveland Watkiss, who's a jazz singer, actually, but who got involved as the MC at the Metalheads, at Goldie's Metalheads Club at the Blue Note in London in the late 90s, a very key club. He was the only MC. He actually didn't come from a reggae MC background, but he knew reggae very well. And he said, the thing about Jungle was I welcomed it as an old friend, because if you know reggae, you know when it's going to start and stop. You know the format of the music, and that opens up space for the MC. And initially, the MC was there really just to get the party started, to address the audience, to create this antiphonal kind of environment. This is a key component of kind of the Africanity of black music in the West. You know, there are certain elements which have been carried over, the so-called African retentions, that's what the musicologists call them, from African ways of making music and culture. And the point is that antiphony is best thought of as call and response. You know, it's about a relationship. It's not just listening to music or just dancing to music. It's actually involving the audience as an active member of the production of the musical space. And it's the MC who mediates between that. So they talk to the audience, they get them riled up, they give them instructions, they tell them funny stories. They are a part of the way in which the culture is created and that particular musical experience. And this wasn't done initially on record. This was done in the dance. But, you know, guys grabbing the mic and hyping the crowd using this strange argot of kind of mixture of patois and cockney and all kinds of references to what's going on. Much of this drew on what had been happening in British sound system culture. There were sound systems of the 80s, like Saxon, where the MC started to move away from a strictly Jamaican oriented way of speaking on the mic to a much more British one. So you got people like Smiley Culture and Asher Senator, Peter King, who developed new styles of talking, which were more indigenous to the UK than they were Jamaican. And those same, and that, you know, put it like this, those are the older brothers and, yeah, and uncles and cousins, or sometimes even the same people as the MCs who popped up on the jungle scene. And through that, they developed a new way of voicing black music in Britain. You know, hip hop had come along in the early 80s and there had been British hip hop, but it was very, very much based on an American model, to the point where the British hip hop has put on American accents. They were copying, you know, KRS-One or Chuck D or Nas. Someone like Rodney P, it took him several years. Rodney P is a prominent British, you know, rapper. It took him, in my interview with him, he told me, you know, it took him several years to realize that he didn't have to speak in an American accent to do hip hop. He could develop his own sound. And the way he did that was by drawing back on his Jamaican past, and by closing the gap between hip hop and reggae culture and rave culture. And that became so important and became a proving ground for these brilliant vocalists, incredibly intelligent, funny, often speakers on the mic, which massively informed the emergence of an authentic British vocal style in grime right at the end of the 1990s with Wiley and Kano and Dizzy Rascal and all of these guys. And when you talk to those guys, which I did, they will tell you it was Jungle and the Jungle MCs who were my model. MC Moose, Navigator, you know, Conrad, just great. And for a while, they weren't famous at all and they weren't on record. If you wanted to hear this stuff, you had to go to the clubs. So it gave the clubs a particularly strong sense that this was a forward-thinking music and this was a music that was being improvised. Because these guys are not, you know, they may have prepared some lyrics, but they're not reading from a script. They haven't written it down. It's coming off the top of their heads based on their own kinetic intelligence, you know, how to fit the words with the rhythms.
This question, I think, focuses more on the historiography or the significance of jungle as a genre and its inclusion in the literary canon. You write in your book, one aim of writing a book about these historical and cultural forms now is to render musical cultures that are in danger of being forgotten into text. So why, in your opinion, have the musical genres you write about, including and specifically jungle, been written out of or left out of the historical canon? Over to you.
For some people, popular music is not an important part of history. I don't know personally that many historians who actually work on popular music, although I think that's a shame because it seems to me that as a pop, you know, it is, music is the primary popular art form, it's the most mobile, and it carries the traces of the social world, the politics, the identity work that's been happening in your culture. So it's a great way into those questions. So in one sense, I'm not quite sure, but it seems a shame that it's been neglected. But another problem with it is because this is primarily an oral culture. I mean, even though there are records, you know, literally records, so that there's some things have been kept for posterity. What's happening in these clubs is not being recorded. This was before mobile phones. This was before, you know, there were very few video cameras. There was no one there taking notes. People's memories aren't that great. Lots, you know, it's kind of a quite an intense, often quite druggy kind of world where people's memories falter, about what actually happened. So it's actually really hard to record this stuff. As the historian Laura Putnam says, it can be very difficult to record cultures which are not themselves text-based cultures, because of course the historian spends their time in an archive. Well, where's the archive for this kind of stuff? How do you go and find it? Now, you can find traces of it in online, in various, you know, discussion forums and the work of kind of people who don't consider themselves historians. They're music writers, but in fact they are doing the job of historians, people like Bill Brewster or Greg Wilson. You know, these are DJs who, as they've grown older, have started writing about what they know about, or Giles Peterson. You can find it in the oral history, which is recorded in the interviews that you can find online, you know, at Resident Advisor or other places where, or podcasts like this, where people talk, you know, and they're not doing it in the sense of formal history, but they are recording a culture. But if it's not written down, it can be written out of history very easily. So I think as a now, you know, an academic, I do think it's important. I don't think it's necessarily important, you know, for the music itself or the people who love jungle that it's written down, although it actually turns out quite a lot of people want to read about this. I've had loads of feedback, you know, perhaps more feedback from people who aren't academics than from academics to my book, who are saying, you know, yes, that's, it's great that this is being recorded. But also for my students and for the students around the world, this stuff needs to be, these books need to be on the shelf of the library so people can go and refer to them, so that they can write about it, so they can understand the history of the kind of thing that interests them, and then write their own history. So in all those ways, I think it's vital that it's done. There is a bias in history, in British history, you know, just like there is an institutional bias in general towards a certain kind of history, you know, history of the Second World War, you know, great men of the past, you know, Winston Churchill. We're going through another round of the kind of narrowing of history. You know, you mustn't say horrible things about the empire. Can't we have a more positive view of how things were? You know, can't we wave the flag around? You know, a false history, to put it simply. And it's really important to get the other view out there. And, you know, let's be honest, there is a scarcity of Black academics, and particularly Black historians in British institutions or in institutions around the world, you know, for very rather stark and obvious institutional reasons, which I'm hoping are changing, but only very gradually. And so, you know, even as a, you know, white middle-class man myself, you know, I'm partially writing a history which isn't entirely my own history, and I'm aware of that. And I want to inspire and pull into the telling of history those people, you know, Black British people, for whom this is really the core of their history. And this is a huge contribution to British culture. Some people might not recognize that or want to denigrate it or think of Black music only as a matter of kind of a bit of fun on the weekend, or even, you know, a scene of crime and danger. But that's a false way of doing it. This is popular art. It's popular art, which is also, in my view, can stand up against opera or, you know, the proms or any other great articulation of kind of musical skill and a kind of cultural relevance. So for all those reasons, I think it's vital to get this stuff in the archive and to have it written down and recorded, you know, for those people who like reading books, which is not everyone, but that's fine. And also to do podcasts like this and find other ways to disseminate this information, to inspire that next generation and to let people know that they need to be writing their own history. So, you know, as far as this is my own story and my own history, this is me writing it down and recording it. And I would like to inspire everyone to think that, feel that they can do that. And they do now have many, many tools by which they can do it: podcasts, blogs, their own websites, but also the good old printed word. You know, I still love books, and I don't think books are going away anytime soon.
The final question, I'm going to mishmash a couple of these together. You'll have to excuse me, Casper. If you had to distill jungle music into three cultural artifacts, what would they be and why? And I'm going to mishmash a slightly different question together with this one, even though it's different, so you'll have to excuse me. What are the three takeaway points that you would want readers to know or remember about your book, It's a London Thing? Over to you, Casper.
Well, there was a period of air horns in jungle, which was one of the kind of defining, air, you know, it's a bit like the vuvuzela that they had at the South African World Cup, but these are kind
still
of
have at the Notting Hill Carnival when it's running.
Exactly,
they have plenty.
Exactly, and basically the reason why this to me matters is that it was the moment when the kind of smoothness of house music, which is something I find quite off-putting in a way, this kind of, sometimes you might be in a club and you just hear the same rhythm the whole night and everything's very, very smooth, and it's partly there to facilitate people, you know, coming up on their highs and whatnot. When jungle comes along, it literally disrupts the dance, and what it does is make the dance floor much more like Notting Hill Carnival, which is the, you know, the Caribbean festival where reggae music has dominated for 20 years 30 years. And having these air horns and talk again, it's part of this antiphony of the dance. It's like you're talking to people and you're saying, I love this particular bit of the music, I'm going to blast my air horn. It's actually noisy and disruptive, but it's giving a signal to the DJ and telling them, you know, I'm enjoying your music. So it's audience participation, and it's just kind of raucous, and there's something about that, and that was, I was very aware of that when I first saw jungle. So that would be one, the air horn. God, what's the kind of, I suppose combat boots, I would probably put in terms of everyone was wearing Timberlands at the time. So there's something about maybe that whole outfit, actually, that kind of urban safari type of concrete jungle look, which is, you know, derived from a certain kind of, you know, Bob Marley aesthetic, you know, Peter Tosh. So it's that kind of look with kind of funky dreads, you know, a sort of dreadlocks, but not, I mean, obviously on not on the white people primarily, but a kind of fashion dreadlock, which kind of took the Jamaican Rastafari aesthetic, but kind of repurposed it for the British city. And then I suppose the other thing is the critical importance of the dub plate in jungle. And again, this is directly derived from reggae culture, which is this special acetate record, which has been, of which you only make a few copies. They're incredibly heavy. They've got metal inside them. This is what you do when you go and cut. You've made a tune digitally, but you go to a cutting place and make a couple of dub plates, which you then distribute to your friends or to, you know, influential DJs, or you just take it, you're the DJ and you take it and play it out that night. So there's an incredible immediacy to the music, because you might have made that song the day before and you're playing it in the club that day. There's a rarity to it. You can only really get it if you're in the dance, because it's not yet been released or commercially available. And it's got a kind of kudos to it. And I love the way that, you know, they don't have a proper label. People scribble little odd things on the label. So there's something special about the dub plate, which is very strongly associated with the Jamaican roots of that culture, which still, you know, sort of suggests the vital importance of the DJ at the center of the culture. Nowadays, DJs play using, you know, digital sticks or Serato or some other kind of digitized music, or even play off Spotify. I don't know. But this was still a moment. Jungle was still about playing records, and dub plates were the key kind of sort of item within it, which distinguished those DJs who were cutting edge from those who were going to the record shop to buy the records which had been released, which might have been made 6 months previously. So that's two. The other thing is gold teeth, I suppose. I mean, Goldie and his gold teeth. I mean, gold teeth were quite prominent in jungle as well. There is an element, you know, there's a kind of ghetto fabulous element of that. There is a certain kind of, you know, flashness to it, and a certain kind of almost sort of comic menace about the gold teeth. But I think that's also, it seems to me, very emblematic of jungle. I don't have any gold teeth myself, but I've got a couple of silver fillings. But those three things together, you know, that if I had pictures of those, that would summon up the jungle moment. I would say that you can't tell the history of a city unless you pay attention to what's happening in the underground, in the places that are not obvious, in the places that are often hidden away for good reason. You know, the black cultures of the sound system, and in general Black British culture, was hidden away because it was trying to get away from police surveillance, from, you know, marauding racists. It was deliberately hidden away to try and for safety and security. But it having things be underground, hidden from view, below the purview of the mainstream, allows creativity to emerge, a DIY aesthetic to emerge. So in order to understand a city, you've got to understand what's happening at that level of culture amongst the people who are often marginalized socially and economically and racially as well. The second thing is you can't understand the nature of a musical genre. I mean, I say at one point in my jungle chapter, it's true that you can't understand jungle without reference to house music and rave, but you also can't understand it without reconnecting it to other forms of music and culture, which have moved around what Paul Gilroy calls the Black Atlantic, you know, for centuries. So it's about paying attention, not just to those things which appear to be there. You know, so if you want to tell the story of London, you can't just tell the story of, you know, what's there in London as if it was all fixed and natural. It's about the flows of things, people, ideas, musical forms through the city, the people who come and maybe don't stay, or the people who are moving around, or the influences that are flowing at a different kind of register to the formal mediascape or the official narrative. So those are the two things. And then I suppose the other thing is that the kind of multiculture which is often celebrated in relation to London, you know, and this came out in the recent report on race produced by the Tory government and their stooges, suggesting that, I don't want to cliche it too much, but making some rather historically naive statements about slavery not just being about, you know, pain and suffering and profit, and also suggesting that British multiculture is a model that we should be proud of and that we could export around the world. Now, there's an element of truth to that, and I would subscribe to that, which is that London, one of the great things about London as a city is it is very diverse. It's got an incredible amount of languages and ethnicities and people who are all rubbing along together more or less comfortably, but, you know, obviously with lots of difficulty as well. But that world is precious and it is unstable and it's not guaranteed. So battles that have been fought in the past need to be refought. You know, what was Black Lives Matter if not the refighting of the same battle, which has been fought over and over again and is never resolved? You know, I thought that through in the 1990s and through a lot often this kind of musical cultures, we had, you know, largely banished racism and kind of, you know, not largely banished, but we had battled against it and established something new. But it's precious, it's embattled, it needs to be renewed. So we need to fight for it, and we need to fight for the space where we can allow people, and often young people of whatever background, to build their own cultures, not dictate what they should be, not limit their access to space or to turn the noise levels down and tell them to stop disturbing people who just bought fancy flats next door. We've got to allow culture to come up from below, because that's actually where culture is made, and that's where the art that has real value to people's lives is made, not really in the concert hall. You know, much as I like concerts, that is not connected to the lives of people in the way that this kind of popular art is. So we need to provide space for that, and increasingly that space is being attenuated through all kinds, you know, through gentrification, through the limitation of access to things, through risk assessment forms you have to fill out, and worries about crowds, and obviously under COVID that has only, you know, I know that wasn't an institutional, you know, issue, that's a public health issue, and we had to lock down, but we need, you know, we people need space to come together and create cultures of their own. And if that was the message that people got out of my book, that I'd be very happy about that.
Casper, thank you so much on behalf of myself, the co-editors of Versus History, and everyone listening out there for this interview. We're so very, very grateful. We're sure it's not escaped your notice that there's not too many of these podcasts around where an established academic actually talks at length and liberty about jungle music, its origin, genesis, impact and significance in such length, you know, and in such detail. So we're so, so grateful. Thank you very, very, very much for your time, Casper. We're all exceptionally grateful. And we wish you every success with your book, It's a London Thing. Thank you for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.